Hello, 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 everybody. I'm Pedro, and I kill rich cunts.
And I am Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot. Today, bringing you the deadliest show we have ever brought to you. That's not entirely true. This doesn't have that high a body count, because what are we talking about today?
Death Wish.
Oh, that's right. We are beginning our two-part installment on Death Wish and its rather limp reboot. Yes, I'm already bashing the reboot right now because I didn't like it then. I didn't enjoy rewatching Death Wish, to be honest. But I know it's going to be the highlight of this endeavor. Because I really don't like this reboot. And while this film has a bit of charm, it is not aged particularly well.
No.
I don't know if I've ever met a longer 90-minute movie than Death Wish.
Dude, yeah. The first, 30 minutes is, 3 hours.
Yeah, what did you say? Hey, this is a revenge movie, right?
Yeah.
When he's in Arizona, you're like, what the fuck is this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, Death Wish could be paced a little bit better. Yeah. It could be paced a little bit better, to say the least.
10 films in one.
It really does cover a lot, but you certainly know that, if anything, Charles Bronson loves to pack and unpack, because we see it so many times in the movie, and I'm not really certain why we see him do this.
Yeah.
So, Death Wish came to us in the year 1974, correct?
74.
So, there's a few things I want to talk about before we get into the movie. First off, as always, Meredith, what are your socials?
I don't have any.
That's right. Fuck social media. That was a goddamn lie.
We need it to live.
Yes, we really do. You can find us at Gritty Reboot, and that's an Instagram and a TikTok. That's the easiest way to get a hold of us. Or if you want to send something a little bit more in depth than a simple message, you can send us an email, grittyrebootcast@gmail.com. And that way you can send, like I said, any attachment you want to, just no dick pics.
Yeah.
You know what? What the hell? Send them all you want. I don't care.
No, now we're going to get a wave of just penises.
I'll rate them. Sure. I'll be like, that's a solid 7 right there. You don't know the rating scale. It could be out of 100. It could be out of 10. You have no idea.
Okay.
What? You don't like my avenue to make money here? Is it not going to work?
No.
All right. Hey, listen, I'm trying new things here. So, how did you first hear about Death Wish?
My dad.
So, you watched it with your dad first?
Yep.
Do you remember watching it with him?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a movie that he particularly enjoys? It seems like your dad would really like this movie.
I think so. I think he does like this movie.
Yeah. Your dad watches it and goes, this movie speaks to me.
I don't think he's seen it in a long time, but if we put it on right now, he'd probably watch it.
I don't doubt that. This movie felt older than some of the older films than we've covered on the show, to be honest. With the exception of maybe the attack and the rape scene, this movie is really paced and plods along like a 50s kind of thriller.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't have a great memory of really watching Death Wish. I was aware of what it was about. So, obviously, I had caught a few of the films on cable because there are many sequels. Can you guess how many sequels there are?
5.
5. Okay. You are correct. Can you name them?
Death Wish 1 through 5.
What do you think? The fifth film has a subtitle. Which one of these is fake? The Reckoning? The Face of Death? The Gun of Justice?
Which one is fake?
Which one is real? Which one is the actual subtitle of that film?
The Gun of Justice.
The Face of Death is what it is.
Jesus.
The series goes in some weird directions, to say the least. So I was more familiar with those movies than I really was with the original. My dad wasn't the biggest fan of this movie. I mean, he liked it, but he didn't let's watch Death Wish. It wasn't something that I really got exposed to until...
He does kill a bunch of, minorities.
He does, but he kills some whites. He kills some whites.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an equal... He'll kill whoever. We'll get into it. What a mug slut he is later in this movie, trying to draw attention from all these
he's
muggers.
Showing his legs.
Yeah, he's like, look at all this affluent wealth I got.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm a little tipsy. Yeah. It's almost like Promising Young Woman. Remember that whole gag in that movie? She pretends to be shit-faced, with a broken heel. And then when she gets home, she exposes that they were going to try to date rape her. She catches these guys off guard. I almost feel like it's sort of that same thing, except instead of the accusation of date rape, he then shoots them with a gun instead.
Mm-hmm.
So one is way worse than the other. You can come back from a gunshot. A date rape accusation, that can torpedo you nowadays.
Yeah.
It's so difficult out there for the rapists. Won't anyone ever think of them?
Uh-huh.
So, I got a little off track of what I was talking about.
Yeah, you did.
I did. So, I was aware of this movie through parody. And obviously, there was one big parody that was always around.
Simpsons?
Here we are, Branson, Missouri.
No, Pelly. This is Bronson, Missouri. Me.
Well, how do we get to Branson?
Number 10 bus.
Hey, Ma, how about some cookies?
No dice.
This ain't over.
Tonight, we review an aging Charles Bronson in Death Wish 9.
I wish I was dead. Hey.
So to me, these movies have always been coded as lame.
Because
Charles Bronson is sort of old and lame and a yesteryear's action star. So I never took the movies very seriously and just sort of dogged them. And then I think in college I had to write a paper on Taxi Driver. And so I watched Death Wish, which is a good companion piece if you really think about it. They have similar content. If one is done by the absolute master of cinema at his peak, and the other is the guy who made Death Wish. So they're not really the same kind of flick, but they do have similar content. And so when I watched it, I was ultimately pretty disappointed by it because I thought it would be more than what it was.
Yeah.
Because it's not a lot. Is I think my biggest problem with Death Wish is the movie has a lot of story behind it. It has a lot of lore about like what this meant at the time. I think a lot of people don't really understand that in 1974, you know, America is still fresh from losing the Vietnam War. There are a lot of wounds in America. Crime is rising at a rate that really scares people. And this movie absolutely fucking resonates with America when it hits. Like it does. People are in the audience cheering for this movie. I had a government professor in college once, and he talked about this movie briefly. And I after class, I approached him about, because he talked about going to a screening where people were cheering. And he really went on that people absolutely loved this movie. And it really began a true love affair with like a realistic vigilante that began in the 70s. And I think you see that reflected in cinema. And that this movie was sort of like the most realistic one because Charles Bronson, even though he is Charles Bronson, plays a regular kind of guy.
Yeah.
For the most part. So it does sort of work. He is just kind of a regular dude. This is like ends up like a power fantasy, I think, for a lot of people who have a hatred of crime and feel powerless against it, or people who are just naturally violent dicks, you know, who I think see themselves as like a Batman persona. If only I had the opportunity. So I think there was a lot of wish fulfillment in this movie, and it just hit at a weird time for America to where like it could absolutely be propelled into being as big a hit as it is. I remember years later, I was watching an episode of Seinfeld, and this is probably like 96, 95, maybe. You're almost 10 years past the last sequel, and they had a parody in there, Death Blow, which was a reference to Death Wish, and I was so confused by that, and it just didn't make any sense to me that this movie was a much bigger deal for New Yorkers, and it really hit about how they felt about crime.
Yeah.
And I think that's just something that's incredibly interesting about the movie, because it is a $3.7 billion budget, ends up making over $22 million, which in the 70s is a massive hit.
Yeah.
That's why it got four extra sequels.
Five?
Well, this is the first movie, then four
sequels.
Yeah,
I guess you're right.
Yeah, so five movies. You're so right. And, well, I mean, the five movies and a reboot, which got no sequels.
Mm.
So that's pretty much how I feel about Death Wish at the time. And I think that's the main thing I want to impart to people is, like, that's why this movie got the acclaim that it did and got those numbers, is because it just happened to come out at a time when people really had their opinions changed and their feelings changed about how they felt about crime.
Yeah, because I don't think it's a particularly good movie. I've seen better movies of this genre.
Well, I think, like, well, I just talked about Taxi Driver. I think that's a better example of what this movie wants to be. This is based off a book. Now, this book was not a bestseller, by the way. It was written by Brian Garfield, who was a good writer. I wasn't a particularly big fan of Mondays. But he did write this book. And the thing that is different from this to the screen is the book is about the gray area being a vigilante. Like, it's not about, like, rah, rah, let's go clean up these streets. It's about, like, the realistic effect that that's having on this guy who can't stop trying to dispense this justice. Someone who has a death wish.
Well,
like, he's just going out there trying to do this to make sense of the world. And if he dies, he dies.
His wife was murdered and his daughter was raped.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's some serious crime.
It really is. It really is.
A freaking great scene.
Yeah, yeah, and that's sort of the difference.
Brutal attack.
I did not read the book, but I was recapped on it, and I know that's the main difference. The book does not really glamorize the idea of being a vigilante. It's just something that Paul is. But the movie, I wouldn't necessarily glamorize it, but it never judges him for doing it.
No.
It never, ever judges him for doing it. And the book was just very different in that way. You know, he was an accountant, and You know, that book was going to get a very different adaptation at one point. Legendary director Sidney Lumet was going to do an adaptation with Jack Lemmon as the lead. And I think that fits the way that protagonist is described in the book better. And I think no one would ever confuse Jack Lemmon and Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
So, and I think that lets you know how that's kind of different about a normal man driven to violence, where Bronson already seems like he's going to kick your ass at the start of the movie.
Hell yeah.
And let's see, how's this movie start? Does it start with violence?
No, it actually starts in a nice way. We have a couple on a beach on their vacation in Hawaii.
So this is, I think, I love the shift we're going to make in a second here, but we start off with this. By the way, Bronson, great shape. I think he's 52 when took this part on. He looks great. And he wants to fuck on the beach, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he wants to fuck on the beach. And his wife's like, hell no, we're not doing that. We're civilized people.
Yeah.
And I think that
Hope Lang.
Hope Lang there plays his wife.
Beautiful.
Charles Bronson plays Charles Bronson, who also happens to be the protagonist of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Bronson is never a character. He's just Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
That's
he's not even acting. He's just being Charles Bronson.
I know I'm stealing one of your facts right now, but I'm using it right now. And you know which one it is. He was when he was pitched the role. He was initially excited about it when he told the director. He's like, I want to do that. And he's like, oh, you're excited for the role? He's like, oh, no, not the role. I want to shoot muggers.
Yeah.
And that is Charles Bronson to a T right there. He read a movie about a regular guy killing criminals. Like, yeah, I can fucking do that. That sounds like me. And he was all on board. And weirdly, this is the best acting of his career, and he's terrible.
Yeah.
But continue on.
All right. Well, we meet our couple here. Charles Bronson and Hope Lang, like we said.
Yeah.
They're on the beach taking pictures. He takes a lot of pictures of his wife.
Paul and Joanna Kersee, by the way. I believe it was Paul Benjamin in the book, but they changed it to Kersee here.
Yeah. They go back to the hotel and they have a good old time. And then we get the title, Death Wish. Boom. And there's the title.
So the soundtrack is done by Herbie Hancock, and this is like almost mid-O's ominous tones is like what we have when the title hits, right?
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's just like, dong, like scary, because now we're back in the city, and, you know, they're framed, you know, through doorways, like always surrounded by people where they had this idyllic framing prior in the earlier scenes when they were on vacation. Something really groundbreaking, but it does drive home the point that the city is a dangerous place, and even though there's people everywhere, they're sort of trapped there. I do want to mention that I don't think the film is particularly pretty about how it shoots New York, or even how it shoots Maui, which I'm assuming it's Maui. It is Maui, because the guy says it later.
Yeah.
It's a bad joke about Maui.
Yeah. Maui, Wowie, or Jowie.
Kitchen Zowie.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. But, and by the way, this place over the credits, this takes forever, by the way.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that makes the movie feel like it's 1,000 years long.
The couple's in traffic. There's some 70s music.
You are just waiting in traffic with them.
The couple is home, and they get ready for bed.
We talked a few weeks ago about American Werewolf in London, how there was an excellent scene of waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie doesn't have an excellent scene of waiting. Mm-hmm. We're just, you know, logging time with these guys.
I forgot. Before they go upstairs, they check the mail.
Yes, they check that. They do everything during these credits. We don't get any character interaction or any. There isn't a single shot of substance in this segment of the intro. Once the title card comes up, it's just them doing mundane shit, which I know is the point. It's supposed to say they have regular mundane lives, but you can move a little bit faster and let us know that shit. You know, we got it.
Well, we see the next day after they go to bed, they wake up and Paul goes to where he works, and he's an architect.
He's an architect. Maybe one of the least believable film.
I know.
Career.
If I saw an architect like that looked like him, I'd be like, really?
It's not the way you hang a building there. It's one of those things. It reminded me of Elizabeth Shue in The Saint. She plays an advanced like physicist, and it's the worst casting ever.
Yeah.
Maybe Denise Richards as a nuclear scientist as well in Tomorrow Never Dies, one of the bad Bond movies.
Mm-hmm.
That was another like, no, that's not even close. not buying it.
Yeah. Juxtaposed.
Look at you with juxtaposed.
Juxtaposed against Paul talking business.
Mm-hmm.
Is Joanna and Carol shopping in a store?
So they're shopping in a store, and they are completely oblivious to three Hooligans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like we're both on the same page. And that's all. Right now, they're just mere hooligans. They're running around the store causing all this disorder. They're completely no-sold by the Kersey's.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know why. It's like they like don't even acknowledge their existence.
They don't even exist.
They're so far in their upper middle class bubble.
And one of them is Jeff Goldblum.
They can't see the crime. One of them, truly, one of them is indeed
Jeff Goldblum. Baby Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, you don't really think of Jeff Goldblum as a thug, a criminal. And of course, that's who I quoted earlier. He has that great line earlier. I kill rich cunts.
I got a fun...
I didn't clip that. I should.
I got a fun fact about that. I'm going to save for later.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be waiting for it. If I don't get it, I'll be so disappointed.
It's going to be great.
I know you're already mad. I stole that one fact.
Yeah, I know. You're just ruining everything.
I know. I'm going to take them all. I don't look at your notes. That's why I love to get it organically, because I knew, like, but I knew that was one I was going to take anyway. It belonged to me. I was there. I saw it.
Well, maybe Jeff Goldblum and gang show up and harass the store patrons. They end up following Carol and Joanna home.
Yeah, and by the way, Goldblum's in like a Jughead hat, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's in like a Jughead hat, little crown. He's the leader.
Yeah.
I guess. So, yeah, well, no, he's freak number two, right? Not number one.
I can't remember how he's...
Yeah, because he doesn't have a name.
No,
he doesn't have a name. He's only known as like freak number one.
I may have written it down.
He is freak number one, so he is the leader. Okay, I just checked. Yeah, he's freak number one.
They follow her home, and they burst through the door after pretending to be delivering her groceries.
Yeah, yeah. They're so unconcerned with the world of crime that these guys can easily get in the house.
Yeah, they're they're vandalizing the inside of the hallway with paint, spray paint.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a pretty brutal scene.
Yeah, and yeah, then you have the attack.
Yeah, there's no real way to cut it. They beat the mother down. She doesn't really get bloody, per se. They do obviously kick the living hell out of her, but they orally assault the daughter.
Yeah.
You don't see the penetration.
But you know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. It is depicted. You see the guy's ass as he's holding her head right in front of his penis. So, I mean, it's not even implied. And I think when they spray paint
They spray paint her butt.
They spray paint her butt as well. And that I'd forgotten about until I watched it this time. So it is a pretty rough scene to watch, yeah. You know? And you need this scene. You really do. Now, the book does not show this. Paul comes home and finds out what happened from the police, you know. He never, ever sees this. The reader is never, ever told about this event. But in the movie, you have to have it because Charles Bronson cannot convey the emotions necessary about, like, what he's feeling during this. So we need to see it to have the impact with Bronson. Because I will mention this in a moment when we talk about his reaction. Anyway, the thugs beat them down and steal, because they only have like $20 on them.
Yeah, they don't have much on them. In fact, I think they even make comments about
it. Yeah, they only have like $18. It's like now, like somebody robbed me. I'm like, why don't I have cash on me?
And then they get the hell out of there. And Carol basically falls on the floor and then crawls over her dying mother and calls the police.
Yeah.
And then we come into Jack, who is Paul's son-in-law, who calls him dad.
A lot. He calls him dad a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much more. It made me physically uncomfortable to watch the motion picture.
He calls his dad.
Yeah. So.
And he lets him know what happened. Kinda.
Yeah. This is a strange conversation. It's a very movie conversation. It's not how people really talk. It does the job. It lets us know that the women have been injured and they take him to the hospital.
Yeah. He rushes to the hospital.
At no point is Bronson concerned. At no point is Bronson anything but Bronson.
Jack fills them all in as much as he can and much as he knows about their condition. Basically, Paul is told that his wife is killed, but Jack is told that his wife is still there.
Yeah. So this whole scene is weird. I just want to mention that.
Yeah, because he's like, my name is Paul Kersey.
It's like no one who staged this scene had ever been to like a real hospital. Mm-mm. Because first of all, the police officer they meet with is just like, hey, how you doing? He's like, well, they were beaten. You know, it is what it is. Like, he's just a very matter of fact. He's not even, he's not really trying to ask questions. He's just sort of gleefully giving the information. Mm-hmm. And it's not even much information. When the doctor comes out, he looks at Jake, right?
Or Jack. Yeah, Jack.
Jack, pardon me. He looks at Jack. He's like, your wife's going to be fine. And he's like, hey, what about my mom? Oh, that bitch dead.
Yeah.
It's like the doctor could give a fuck, right? He's like, oh, yeah, she's dead. Sorry, she expired an hour ago or something. I don't know. I got lunch. Yeah. It just was a very strange way. And then to top it off, Charles Bronson, I could feel like the director went over and was like, I need you to cry, Charles. And he was like, I've never cried in my life, you son of a bitch. Because he looks like he has, like, indigestion. It's like he got his steak. He wanted medium rare, and it was well done. Like, that's the look he gives on the camera. Like, he is like, this ruined my day. Like, and that's it. Like, he's just like, I really wanted some bread. I wanted that bread, but I can't have it. You know, like, that's what it's like. It doesn't seem like my wife is dead and my daughter's been raped. It's like, darn. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And, I mean, it's laughable. I've heard people talk about this being, like, their favorite movie, and I'm like, did we watch the same movie?
I picked a 10-star review.
You should have. I'm glad you did, because I wanted to talk about that. I mean, it helps to add to the charm of the movie, in my opinion, because it's, you know, Bronson attempting to act, but it does get us there. His wife is dead, so the next scene, I believe, is a funeral, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just funeral.
I wrote, they do a close-up on Charles Bronson's face where he does not do anything with his face.
No, he doesn't. He's like, I almost feel like the second right before it cuts, he's going to let me go. Is that enough? Is that good? Or is he just going to like fall to the lens? Whichever one, I don't know.
But then we, like you said, we quickly move on to the funeral. Carol is clearly distraught still.
Yeah. She's interacting with people, but she's...
like catatonic.
Yeah, nearly catatonic. She's in a state and she's getting worse. And that also occurs in the book as well.
Yeah. Paul goes to the police station and asks about his case. And there's some more Charles Bronson acting in this scene as well. We have the detective that says Mr. Kersey like 8 times. And
Yeah.
And less than a minute.
Mr. Kersey? I've got this. Mr. Kersey?
Mr. Kersey? Mr. Kersey?
I don't know why I made him that kind of character. Mr. Kersey, we got to go to the speakeasy. Oh, no. I'm sorry. I brought him out of the wrong era. Now I went from the 30s to the 70s.
The detective basically tells Paul that he wants his daughter to come in and try to identify the people who did this, but she's in no state.
Yeah.
He's basically like, he'll try, but can't promise anything.
So I do want to mention, so here's the neat little thing. The book is a shorter book. It's really about the mindset of a person. And the movie isn't about the mindset of this character, really. It's about the revenge. Because a movie can be about the mindset of a character, it doesn't need like a big dramatic conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to mention, with her not seeing the mugshots, we have no narrative conclusion to that violent murder and rape that we just saw in this movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. You don't realize as a viewer at that moment, we've closed the door on that chapter. Like,
you're never going to see them again.
Jeff Goldblum would never get his comeuppance.
Mm-mm.
He's going to go out there killing rich cunts every day. And it's so strange. The movie's just like, all right, bye. See ya. See ya, storyline. That's one of the strange holdovers from the book that they carry. And I don't really know why. Of all the things they could have changed, that was probably the one that they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't.
There's a scene where Carol's husband tries to touch her and she screams. Sort of real uncomfortable stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even like a sexual touch. He literally tries to comfort her.
He just tries to put his arm on her. Husband.
Yeah. And after that, so it only gets worse from here.
Mm-hmm. Paul is alone in the dark watching outside as some people start some stuff outside in the car. They break the windows and start beating up this little car. I don't know. They're just hooligans.
Yeah, and this is the most enthused like Bronson looks throughout the entire movie, because he's just like, he stares out that window. He's like, crime. Yeah. Like, it's like, he's feeding off of it. Like, it needs my justice.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most motivated I've ever seen him look in a motion picture.
Yeah.
That wasn't directed by Sergio Leone.
Next day, we have Paul and his boss are talking, and he basically is like, I want to offer you this job in Tucson, Arizona. I think you'll be great for it. And he's like,
So, of course, he says, I can't do it. I've got a movie here that we're doing. We're working on a narrative here for a revenge movie here in New York. I can't go anywhere else, right? That would be a stupid thing for a movie to do. Would be to leave your primary location for action for a completely unrelated sequence to the rest of the narrative.
He's like, I got to get out of town.
But that is exactly what occurs.
Yeah. Like, fuck my daughter.
Yeah.
Fuck my dead wife. I got to get out of town.
Yeah. He talks about Carol. He's like, I got to stay for that. But eventually just decides to go anyway.
Yeah.
I just want to mention, it is sort of a strange thing, but the movie just does take a detour here. And the detour is basically so we can find out the guns are great.
Mm-hmm. Paul tells his son-in-law that he thinks he should take Carol to someone like a psychiatrist. And basically, Jack has nothing. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He's like doing the best he can for her, and he's kind of fighting with his dad a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that the older guy is like, she needs a psychiatrist, and the husband's just like, yeah, we can make it work.
Yeah.
He's like, we'll figure it out. You know, I got this guy. You know, I got a priest we've been talking to.
Yeah. Paul is trying to convince him, maybe go with, take Carol and let's go to Arizona together.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, because you remind her of the rape. And he's like, why the fuck do I remind her of the rape?
Yeah.
And I don't blame him. I'd be like, what did I do?
That was
so strange.
In all fairness, that was a really fucked up thing to say to him.
Yeah.
He's like, he's like, I lost my wife in that.
Yeah.
My entire life was destroyed too. What the fuck what do you mean I remind her of that?
Yeah.
And he suffered as much as anybody has here. At that moment, you could have slapped that guy.
I thought it was just such a weird thing to say.
It is. And Brunson doesn't play it well. Like, he tries to be outraged.
He tries.
But he's more just like, why do I remind her? Like he's almost unfamiliar about how a human should respond. Listen, I don't want to rag on Brunson all that much, but he sucks. He does. He sucks. If this movie had a real actor in it, it would be really fucking good. I think if it had... If you had Sidney Lumet doing this with a similar script with Jack Lemmon, I think Lemmon could easily portray some of the things that have to be spelled out loud in this film.
I have a list of some of the people that were going to play Paul Kersey, but Charles Bronson got it.
Charles Bronson got it because he's already an action guy with limited range, and that's okay. I mean, like, you know, Schwarzenegger's got limited range. We love him.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't grow up. We grew up a little bit with Charles Bronson, but he was already a joke by the time I was getting into action movies.
Well, good old Polly Boy is out walking around and someone tries to mug him. And he basically just punches them straight out.
Oh, he uses those quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah, we forgot to mention he goes to a bank earlier and he gets...
He gets like
$20 worth of quarters, I think.
No, he gets $2. Maybe $2? It was $20. Maybe it was $20.
So he hits him with 8 quarters. The guy was like, ow, why did you do that? That was mildly inconvenient. He goes, yeah. I've got a death wish.
Did I mention the title was card not rolls. My strong suit?
So anyway, that ends the movie right there. He got the quarters from the bank and he puts them in a sock and he smacks them with it. And he gets a little feel for it.
Yeah, he goes home back. And has a drink and starts his practice swing.
He wildly swings it around. Like, I like the idea of this scene more than I like its execution. Like, he's becoming more comfortable with the idea of fighting back.
Yeah.
It's just not who he is. This is one of the few scenes that tries to build a character a little bit. And it's nice. Brunson's okay here, you know. He doesn't have to say anything, so that helps.
We're back on our side mission of Paul going to Arizona, and he's there to survey some land.
He's doing some architecture DLC right now.
Mm-hmm.
His open world New York crime adventure.
And then he watches, for some reason, an old Western reenactment.
This is one of the best scenes in the movie.
You think so?
Yeah, because this is... No, he sees the nature of man in this. He sees the violence and how people just can sit back and watch it and deal with it and take it. You know, they've become accustomed to it. It's how society is now. They just let it happen and deal with it. And he doesn't have to be that way. He can be like these guys, a man of action. And it does sort of occur to him. And it's one of the few times this movie doesn't say something out loud directly. It actually just kind of shows you him kind of seeing it and making the realization. So I like this scene.
I didn't read that into that scene.
You just look at it as like, here's an extreme close-up of Bronson's nostrils.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it is a very tight shot. They're like, hey, you want to know if Charles Bronson's got nose hair? This is the movie for you.
Paul goes back to the land, and they start making plans, hammering some markers. Yep, that's all that happens.
So, what's this guy's name? Amos? Ames?
Oh, that guy, the country
Ames,
dude.
Right?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I didn't write him down.
It's not important. He doesn't play a big role in this movie or not.
Yeah. I think I call him Tex.
They're not in Texas.
I know, but that's why I did it, because I thought it would be ironic.
Okay, so...
Because he has a very ironic car.
He does. He does.
Come on.
Yeah.
Totally Tex.
He's driving a car that's in the shape of Massachusetts.
No. It's a car. It's like an Oldsmobile, but it's got like horns on the front.
Yeah, like longhorns.
Like longhorns on the front.
Like longhorns on the front of it.
And it's got cow print all over it. It's, yeah. It's very Texas.
It's got wood paneling as well, but that was just, but that was the style at the time. So Tex, he wants to build on this property, but he does not want to bulldoze the hills down.
Yeah. Because
he likes the layout of Arizona.
Yeah.
Arizona, which, right?
Yeah.
Arizona.
Tucson.
Tucson. So he likes the...
I lived in Tucson.
Huh?
I lived in Tucson. Way, way back when.
What was it? Was it nice there?
Oh, I remember loving Arizona.
Oh, really?
My brother lived there for a while and we would visit him. And man, I loved visiting him.
I have no beef with Arizona. We did nice camping in Arizona, remember?
Yeah.
That doesn't help with the show. Anyway, so no, this is Camping Hour with Pedro and Meredith. So, yeah, he, MacReady finds the bloody underwear. No. Where were we?
Paul ends up at a gun range and shows that he's got skills for killing.
This is where we find out he was a conscientious
objector.
Can you say this word? Conscientious objector. CO, not a commanding officer. He object consciously.
Yeah.
No, so we find out that he is not a man of violence at all, but he still knows how to handle a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
And has training and everything like that.
Well, he becomes quickly involved in violence.
Yeah, because once they do the, need to go on the firing range, do a couple shots, he's actually a crack shot.
And this is where I note that at this time, still no killing has happened.
No one has been death wished yet.
Nobody has been killed.
Yeah.
We are like more than halfway through this fucking movie.
Just about. Because I think, the killing does occur just right under halfway.
Paul and Tex are back at the office, and Tex ends up driving him to the airport.
Yeah.
And slips a present for Jack in his luggage, which I thought was like, I immediately was like, oh, he's that's drugs.
Yeah.
He's trying to set him up. I don't know why.
I like how you made a completely different movie in your head. Where but like I Charles totally Bronson's going to have to break out of prison to go kick Tex's ass.
What is he doing with that present?
Yeah. He's like, he got me busted for drugs. I'm going to go kill that guy. He's like, do we need to drive to Texas to get him? No, he lives in Arizona. But why? Should he live in Texas?
Yep.
That's right. I'm doing characters and voices this week. Let's get it going. Come on. We got a movie to finish.
They say their goodbyes. He's off. Jack goes to pick Paul up, and he tells her that Carol's in the hospital, and it's bad. It's real bad.
Yeah, Carol just basically degenerates throughout the course of the movie because she doesn't get her real help. This is a great movie about therapy. You should take it seriously.
He goes to see her, and she's pretty much catatonic.
Yeah, she won't respond to him at all. That's a terrible thing for him to find out, like, right as he gets back and he's feeling pretty good. But it does help push him to where he needs to go.
Paul goes home and looks at pictures of his wife in Hawaii.
Yeah, he remembers the good times. If only he were still there.
He opens the present that Tex got him, and it's a gun.
Cocaine. A gun. It is a gun. It is not a pound of cocaine. Very different movie.
Listen, I was pretty bored at that point, so I had to come up with some stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the 70s just can't go and get a gun wherever. You can't have one in New York, or at least that's what the movie says. Guns are illegal in New York.
And this is where Paul starts to be a horror for shooting people.
Yeah. He's just slutting it up out there.
Yeah, he's showing his leg.
Yeah. He's just letting everybody know, hey, listen to this Rolex. Yeah, you can have this Rolex. Yeah, I'll give it up to anybody.
You see my billfold?
I like to think I'm the first man that ever called Charles Bronson a slut.
Paul is out and about, and he notices a man appears to be following him. He comes up on him and threatens his life. Paul shoots him and leaves really quickly.
And that's pretty much how it goes. It is just that quick a sequence.
And I noted it 44 minutes into this movie.
Yeah, he does come right up to him and tries to mug him, and immediately he turns around and just shoots the guy. I will say, though, the shooting is quick and fairly realistic. How just turn, boom, shoot, you know.
Yeah.
Of all the kills in this movie, I think I like this one the best. And also has repercussions from Paul as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably one of the things I like about it, is immediately after he goes home and he becomes sick, he throws up.
He vomits.
Yeah, he can't. It takes him a while to process what he's done.
The next day, the police show up where the dead man was, and the police try to figure out what happened. But Paul, he goes to work instead. He just keeps on keeping on. Even though he did vomit the night before, it doesn't seem to be affecting him today. He had his breakfast. He's good now. He walks home and sees a bunch of guys beating on some guy. Well, you know what Paul does? He shoots them all dead.
Yeah, he does.
All three of them.
So immediately the movie is kind of going into high gear. I do want to mention, by the way, we've introduced the detective storyline. It's just there.
Yeah.
it's just kind of there to help us get moving along.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, he does more effectively kill these people. And after this, Paul doesn't really have any repercussions. He doesn't feel anything necessarily negative about killing people from this point. He's all in.
He's justified.
Yeah. Justified.
One guy tries to run, but he gets shot in the back. We go back to Carol, and she's with some nuns now. So her husband has chosen to go the route of religion.
Yeah.
Could have cut this whole thing out.
Yeah, because we really do spend a lot of time.
Like, we know Carol's fucked up.
Yeah, and like I said, we really are here for a great deal of time just dealing with this storyline over and over again. And it's a bummer, so it's not, and we don't even resolve it.
Yeah.
We don't even resolve it. Like, it does get resolved in the sequel, technically. Carol is raped again and killed.
Yeah.
So that's her fate, I guess.
The lead detectives give a speech on the suspect, tells them to look for people who were mugged. And then we see two hooligans get on the same train as our favorite friend, Paul.
So Paul's got like groceries, right?
Yeah.
This becomes a plot point later on.
He's reading the newspaper.
And I think one of the things that I like about this idea is that I enjoy that Paul has been riding around the city for hours waiting for someone to mug him.
Yeah.
Like, he's just been like, it's been 4 hours already. I was hoping to catch Carson tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and he's just stuck there just waiting for someone to come and finally mug him.
People get off the train and it's just him and the hooligans.
Conveniently comes down to just like him and these guys that he absolutely would hate.
He gets harassed by the hooligans and the hooligans get shot.
Yeah, and that's pretty much it right there.
He escapes. And then he notices that they're starting to call him the Vigilante.
Which, by the way, is the most generic of generic names ever been. I cannot believe that this is what they went with. Now, they do this in the book as well. He's just the Vigilante.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I guess I can knock it there for creativity, but they could have done something a little bit more. Even the 70s, that's just not a lot at like all.
The Cloaked Man.
Exactly.
Paul watches the press conference and kind of smiles at...
Yeah, he's rather pleased at his press coverage. Yeah, he's really getting into it.
Paul's son-in-law Jack comes by, and Paul is making liver and spaghetti. Ugh.
Yeah, I was like, sure, he does have a death wish. Why? Jesus Christ.
Why that combination?
Exactly. Nobody wants that at all.
Is that an Italian thing?
I mean, I guess. I guess he's supposed to be Italian.
I don't know any Italian, so I can't ask. The next night, Paul gets some grub at a cafe and pays, but someone notices his money and follows him out. They try to rob him, but he shoots them both.
Yeah, takes them both out really easily. He's gotten really adept at killing, which I think is the main takeaway at this point.
Yeah.
The movie does flow a little bit better once the killing starts, but it is still dragged down by all the police intervention in the middle.
Yeah.
So any momentum the movie kind of picks up just kind of goes away. The second we did that.
He runs, one escapes, and goes to the police, but they don't find him. The detectives go to the hospital, and the doc pulls the .32 caliber ammo out of his body. But he eventually dies. The doctor comes out, and he's basically like, there is nothing I can do.
Paul, a pretty effective killing machine at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's one thing he has going for
him. .32 caliber, so.
So yeah, it should be making light work of some of these guys.
Yeah. More vigilante attacks are happening. Detectives are closing in on a suspect. Paul is at a party, and this is the scene where people are, like, hanging out on the stairwell.
Oh, yes, and we have that bit of dialogue where, like, I think he's kind of a racist killer. And the girl responds, and she seems like she's so pleased with herself and goes, well, everybody knows that there are more blacks that are muggers than whites.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's racist fuck.
Loud, too.
Yeah, I know. Like, the movie's proud to proclaim that idea. Mm-hmm. It is pretty funny in day to day.
He goes to a balcony to reflect. Then we see detectives stop by Paul's apartment. They follow Paul. Some of the detectives break into his place and they look around. He swipes a bloody bandage and tests it against the knife. The detective and the DA chat about the case. So there's just, but that's pretty much what happens.
So once again, but the thing about the DA, Chad, is that like the whole storyline becomes toothless because he can't, he's not even supposed to arrest Paul, right?
Mm-hmm.
So any tension from the police investigation is kind of nullified because of that. I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely nullified, but it's certainly a lot of tension would be taken out from that element. The only tension from the movie is if the mugger can hurt him.
Yeah. The lead detective calls him to warn him he's being watched by the police. So he does this because they basically are like, they don't want to arrest the vigilante because they don't want to make him a martyr, basically.
I guess, but it doesn't help that this movie doesn't have an antagonist.
Yeah.
He's just randomly walking around killing people, waiting for storyline to happen. I mean.
Yeah, he's basically, the lead detective is basically told to scare him off. So he calls him, warns him. Paul gets stopped by the police and searched. He gets nothing on him. So Paul didn't have his gun on him at that specific moment. And there's a reason for that. And find out.
Yeah, he has the gun hidden in a special spot.
Paul escapes his building after the watchful eye of the police. He goes to his work where his gun is.
Yeah.
The detective is fast behind him. Paul gets stopped by two guys. He shoots two out of the three. Gets shot by the third guy. He escapes, but Paul goes after the guy. He catches up to him and tells him to draw, then passes out.
He tells him to fill his hand.
Or something. He tells him something.
Fill his hand. I don't know. The first time I ever heard that line as a kid, I was like, and then he grabs his dick. Yeah. He's like, how's that? Oh, no. Why did I make a dick joke? I don't know why, but I think of that every time I watch this scene. But yeah, this is like the first time he decides to be like, you know what? Let's be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be fair. Try to pick up a gun and Paul passes out anyway.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
They take him off to the hospital. The police come. They take him off to the hospital. The lead detective shows up and finds the gun after he doesn't find it. He's the cop that was on the scene found the gun and gives it to the lead detective. Detective goes to the hospital and talks to Paul.
So, by the way, it's Christopher Guest.
Oh, yeah.
It's Christopher Guest, by the way. Legendary comedy director. He's in Spinal Tap. It's a real nothing part. And a very odd scene, by the way. Like, he doesn't tell him about the gun for, like, a couple of moments. Like, well, you should have led with that. Jesus.
Yeah.
But it's sort of whatever.
The detective goes to the hospital and talks to Paul, but he tries to make a deal with him. Leave town, and the detectives will drop the gun in the river. Well,
I guess works.
Paul ends up going to Chicago, and he sees a girl get harassed by hooligans. So he goes to help her, and when the hooligans pass, he takes finger guns and shoots at her.
Yeah, and it's an iconic shot, and it's pretty cool. At least that part is. But Paul doesn't learn anything. Nobody learns anything in this movie. This is barely a fucking movie.
I learned
It's a collection
nothing.
Of scenes
yes.
that don't really,
I
really
learned
add to much.
That I've seen better movies of this genre.
Yeah, this is a pretty pathetic installment of. I know it's one of the first to it, and it's a big deal that because of the fervor it caused. But man, this is a hard pass. I really don't recommend this movie at all. I didn't really enjoy it. I mean, there's a few fun things in it. I just feel like you can get your fix from better movies.
Yeah, I give it a 4.
Yeah, I feel about the same, about a 4. I just, like I said, if you want to understand some references, but even then, there's not a whole lot in this movie that's really iconic other than, you know, the final shot.
Yeah.
It sort of is what it is. It's kind of important, so you can check it out on that for, you know, as sort of a respect to it, but I just find it as a film to be completely underwhelming and uninteresting.
Mm-hmm, I agree. But I do have some interesting stuff to say about this movie. The role of Paul Kersey was originally intended for Steve McQueen, who turned it down.
That would have been kind of cool.
Yeah.
That would have been kind of cool.
Charles Bronson once said of the movie, "I certainly don't advocate anyone taking the law in their own hands. I don't think the film advocates that either. If my films have a lesson, it's that violence doesn't pay."
I don't know. It works out pretty well for Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie's sort of mixed about how it feels about what he does. It never, ever judges him, like we said, you know, so it doesn't have a social message, really. It talks a little bit about, like, the power of what the gun can do and being able to defend yourself a little bit. But it doesn't really condemn Paul's actions in any way.
He doesn't get in trouble. I mean, the police figure out who it's him and he gets in no trouble.
Yeah, because in the book, it ends in a pretty similar way, except when the police catch Paul, Paul can't kill himself, and he decides, okay, I'm going to surrender and go to jail. And the cop, the officer says, nice work, and just tips his hat and turns around and walks away, leaving him to dispose of the body.
Mm-hmm.
He gets away with it, and that's a cooler ending. That's a much cooler ending than what we get here.
After viewing the film, Brian Garfield was dissatisfied with the result of the adaptation of his novel.
I'm not surprised.
Due to its advocacy towards vigilantism, so he wrote a sequel called Death Sentence, which dealt with the consequences of vigilantism.
Yeah, which is a much better book, and that has led to a much, much better movie starring Kevin Bacon that is the same idea and concept, but done so much better. A much more satisfying film, and Kevin Bacon nails the fuck out of what is the same part.
Which is what I was going to say, till somebody rudely interrupted me. So, yeah, there's that. Okay. Can you guess some other actors that might have played the role of Paul Kersey?
Well, I know we talked about Jack Lemmon earlier, but I'm trying to think about who else could have done it. Here's the thing. I'm bad with like 70s movie stars. Gene Hackman?
One of them okay, I'll give you a huge hint. Rain Bird.
Oh my God. You know what? That wouldn't have been so bad.
Yeah.
He didn't knock the fuck out of this part, actually.
He was one of the ones. Burt Lancaster was another one.
Oh, I'd have dug that.
And Frank Sinatra.
That could have been badass. That could have been badass. Frank's an underrated actor. I think he could have done a really good job with it. They literally hired
the worst one?
Yeah. They literally hired the worst actor they could have found besides, you know, a literal baby Steven Seagal.
Yeah. On his film debut, playing a violent thug, Jeff Goldblum said, "Did it bother me? It was such a brutal part." "No, it was the first movie I'd gone for, and I got it." Director Michael Winner said Goldblum's audition for the part was loose and brilliant.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
This film was said to have inspired several copycat incidents of vigilantism around the country. The most famous is in 1984, New York City subway car shooting of four views by Bernard Goetz, who was approached by the teens on a subway car demanding money. The four were all shot and wounded by Goetz, with the New York tabloids dubbed the Death Wish Vigilante. And that's all I got.
I think those are pretty solid facts.
Yeah.
I enjoyed them. I know I stole the one about Bronson earlier. You know, and then we talked about Jack Lemmon and Sidney Lumet, but yeah. I always like to steal them. And I want to talk about that as well. I imagine a world where Sidney Lumet made an Oscar-winning version of this movie and this concept, but we didn't get that. And I think we get a B-movie that I don't really enjoy, but I heard that you found someone who did enjoy it.
I did. I found a 10-star review. And this title of this review is Bronson's Finest Hour.
I'm sorry. that wasn't a joke. I shouldn't have laughed immediately at the start of this.
Gripping tale of Paul Kersey, a liberal architect who takes revenge on the criminals of New York after his wife is murdered and his daughter left catatonic from an attack in the apartment by a bunch of random thugs. Bronson is particularly good at portraying the generous liberal Paul at the beginning of the movie and how he changes into a steely, ruthless Paul at the end. This is one of several things which make him stand out and make it just a little bit different from the other similar movies. For example, the original attackers are never seen again, elevating Paul's subsequent actions from simple revenge to all-out war against the criminal underworld of New York, which has the knock-on effect of scaring off the other criminals and making the general populace tougher.
I call it narratively hollow. But
I especially enjoyed the part where the building foreman says about the mugger he has and his crew caught, "Well, we roughed him up a little," and the news reporter then says the mugger had two broken arms, a broken leg, and cracked ribs, or something like that. Also good is how it shows the evolution of Kersey's various reactions to his circumstances, from being afraid to hold a sock of coins to being sick after he shoots his first victim, to actually going out and flashing his money around, attracting potential muggers so he can kill them.
What a slut.
Bronson's facial expressions are exceptional, looking genuinely surprised and shocked by his potential muggers, while at the same time shooting them sometimes twice to make sure they are dead. Another point that makes it stand out from the norm is that Paul's getting away with it is not a result of a sympathetic detective telling him he has 5-minute head start or something like that, but is officially sanctioned for reasons that make perfect sense.
That's how the sequel ends.
Okay, so the rape scene is brutal, but I would say necessary in the context of the film Justified. The son-in-law, Jack Toby, is so annoying that in real life, any self-respecting father-in-law would beat the living crap out of him. Something I can't understand is why Jack keeps calling Paul dad.
Okay, so it's not just us.
No.
It's not just us. Because it's so weird to dad. Like, dude, chill.
In fact, he says, is this an American tradition? In Ireland, where I'm from, men generally call their fathers-in-law by their first names and call their own fathers dad.
I've never called your dad. I was calling him Randy, yeah.
Although now that I write this, I'm just wondering if the character was made deliberately annoying to throw Paul's toughness into sharp relief, and also if his passivity and willingness to do nothing is there to provide a counterpoint to Paul's decision to stand up for himself, and therefore a stimulus for his actions. In this context, the character is exactly what is needed. I love this film far better than I thought I would. I could watch it over and over again. I provided you are not too easily offended. Would recommend it to anyone.
Well, I mean, I guess it is kind of offensive. I will say that.
He loved the movie, though. Well written.
I don't even know what to say about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because it's like he's coming from a different film entirely.
Yeah, he enjoyed the fuck out of this movie.
Oh, my God, did he? Like, he's like a tour de force of acting.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I don't even know where to even begin with that review. But, hey, I know this movie has some fans. I've read a lot about people who were just so excited about this movie.
Did I even run through the reviews? 4.7 user reviews, 66% on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.9 on a 10 on IMDb, and a 51% on Metacritic. So, movie got some good reviews. So, people do either love it or hate it.
Yeah, it very much is that way. So, are you ready for the shocker of the day?
Sure.
Roger Ebert says, by the way, can you guess the rating for Mr. Ebert here?
1 out of 5?
I know I usually leave it a surprise, but I wanted the audience to hear your reaction to the fact that Ebert gave this movie 3 stars.
Why? He is so fucked up. That's just so wrong.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. That's right. In the year 1974, Roger Ebert was very much alive. And he reviewed Death Wish. Death Wish is an advertisement for urban vigilantes, done up in a slick, exciting action movie. We like it even though we're turned off by the message. It gives us Charles Bronson in a role that starts out by being somewhat out of character. He plays a liberal, an architect, a former conscientious objector. He turns into the familiar Bronson man of action after his wife is murdered and his daughter is reduced to catatonia by muggers. His immediate reaction is one of simple grief. Then something happens which suggests a different kind of response. His office sends him to Arizona on a job, and he meets a land developer who's a gun nut. The man takes Bronson to his gun club, watches him squeeze off a few practice rounds, and then slips a present into his suitcase when he heads back to New York. It's a .32 caliber revolver. Alone in his apartment, Bronson examines snapshots from his recent Hawaiian vacation with his wife. Then he examines the gun. He goes out into that night, is attacked by a mugger, and shoots him dead. Then he goes home, throws up. But the taste for vengeance, once acquired, has a fascination of its own. And the last half of Death Wish is essentially a series of cat-and-mouse games, in which Bronson poses as a middle-aged citizen with a bag of groceries, then murders his attackers. They are, by the way, everywhere. Director Michael Winner gives us a New York in the grip of a reign of terror. This doesn't look like 1974, but like one of those bloody future cities in science fiction novels about anarchy in the 21st century. Literally every shadow holds a mugger. Every subway train harbors a killer. The park is a breeding ground for crime. Urban paranoia is one thing, but Death Wish is another. If there were really that many muggers in New York, Bronson could hardly have survived long enough to father a daughter, let alone grieve her. The movie has an eerie kind of fascination, even though its message is scary. Bronson and Winner have worked together on several films, and they have perfected the Bronson persona. He's a steely instrument of violence, with few words and fewer emotions. In Death Wish, we get just about the definitive Bronson. Rarely has a leading role contained fewer words or more violence. And Winter directs with cool precision. He's one of the most efficient directors of action and violence. His muggings and their surprise endings have sort of inevitable rhythm to them. We're set up for each one almost like gunfights in westerns. There's never any question of injustice, because the crimes are attempted right there before our eyes, and then Bronson becomes judge, jury, and executioner. Spoiler alert. He actually wrote that in his review. Spoiler alert. That's what's scary about the film. It's propaganda for private gun ownership and a call to vigilante justice. Even the cops seem to see it that way. Bronson becomes a folk hero as the New York vigilante, and the mugging rate drops 50%. So the police want to catch Bronson, not to prosecute him for murder, but to offer him a deal. Get out of town, stay out of town, and we'll forget all this. Bronson accepts the deal, and in the movie's last scene, we see him taking an imaginary bead on a couple of goons in Chicago. Yeah, so 3 stars.
Were we watching the same movie?
Well, you have to remember, too, Roger Ebert is not watching this movie, you know, from the future with different eyes. He lived in 1974 Chicago, a very violent city as well. I think that perspective and where movies were at the time, I think he could appreciate more of maybe what Death Wish might have innovated at the time. So, and maybe he liked Charles Bronson a bit more than we did.
Hmm.
Who knows? But he did very much enjoy the movie. 3 stars is more than he gave Die Hard, which he only gave 2.
Yeah.
So it is another one we can chalk up to Ebert. While the greatest film critic who ever lived, sometimes he made some interesting decisions. I don't agree with him about Death Wish.
I don't
but
either.
But once again, I don't know what other films really came out against Death Wish in 1974, where action cinema was at that time. But I certainly still don't enjoy the movie.
Well, there were 5 sequels for a reason.
There were. People very much liked these Death Wishes, and they wanted to see more Charles Bronson wishing death upon people.
Yeah.
And if you would like to wish death upon us, please don't. But if you still want to, you can do that at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com, because we have to give it out here because we didn't talk about our socials at the front of the show.
We didn't?
I don't believe so.
Oh, shit.
And so, also you can search for Gritty Reboot at Instagram and TikTok. And that's probably the easiest and quickest way to get a hold of us for any questions.
Mm-hmm.
And with that done, we have completed the first installment here of Death Wish. And so next week, we'll be taking a look at Bruce Willis's 2018 reboot, directed by Eli Roth.
Yeah.
And I know you love this movie, right?
No.
Yeah. You were at your NRA rally, and you talked about how much you really enjoyed Bruce Willis in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that how that went down?
No.
That's not how that went down.
No.
Spoiler, this was the better movie, and we didn't like this one. But tune in next week as we tear apart Eli Roth's Death Wish 2018.
Yep.
See you guys.
Bye.